Hi, everyone. It's Keith. As I'm recording this, it's the 6th of November, 2024, the day after Election Day. Today has been difficult, not because my candidate lost, but because it's a day of fear for many people. And I mean that literally. Already, women in Texas have died because of problems with pregnancies, miscarriages, complications, because the state's anti-abortion laws prevent them from getting the care they needed to save their lives. Today, near where I live, a student in an elementary school who is the child of immigrants asked her teacher if the police were going to come and get her at school. In a high school, a young woman of color who is also gay looked with apprehension into the future and wondered what she was going to do in the face of prejudice that seems to be on the rise. When people say that they are sad today, it is not merely because they lost an election. This is not like a sports team where you shrug off a defeat and move on to the next thing. This is a real existential threat for some people. It is no exaggeration to say their lives are at risk. And in moments like this, it is easy to give in to despair. And believe me, I'm struggling a bit with that myself. But in my other book, called The Book of Constellations, the main character, Rael, has struggled with the darkness in his world as well. And though he does not have a complete solution for how we as humans deal with the darker impulses that live within us, he says the only solution is to learn to love everyone. And on days like today, though it is hard, I try to hold on to that. And I encourage you to hold on to that too, as we go forward together. Love yourself. Protect those who are in need and are vulnerable. And try to love everyone. Thanks for listening. Here's today's episode. An Invisible Sun by W. Keith Timms. Chapter 15. If Ken Zinn's bullet severed some anchor line that kept me moored in my life, it was this moment, I think, when I felt like I had drifted into a current and was helpless but to see where it took me. One might think this was another kind of stuck, but there was a difference. I could have chosen to go home. Instead, I chose to wade out into the rapids with these strangers. It was frightening. Routines are safe because they are predictable. But in routines, there is no growth or change. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Life was not meant to be lived in routines. Whatever was to come, I chose it. And that, somehow, made it feel better. In the tunnel, Matthew let Lucy and Oliver get a few steps away before he stopped me, a hand on my shoulder.
You should be thankful for Sister Lucy. Her capacity for faith is enormous. And she has an uncanny ability to tell friend from foe. And she's almost always right.
I was tired of his manhandling. He could still kill me before I knew what was happening, I'm sure. But I pulled my arm free, squaring my shoulders to look at him, the tattoos all over his face underscoring his serious and grim expression.
But you still don't trust me. If she is almost always right, why don't you trust her judgment about me now? Because it's my job to make sure she is right before she has a chance to be proven wrong.
He lowered his hand and followed them. I hurried to catch up to their swinging flashlights. We moved down several more grave-lined tunnels and through a few intersections. After a couple of minutes, Oliver, looking at his map more than his surroundings, piped up,
I think... Okay, yeah. Up here is the wall. The shaft should be somewhere behind this rock. Look for a vent, or a panel, or a door.
We fanned out along the red-brown rock, playing the flashlights over the surface. I stuck, dear sister Lucy, having no light of my own, and looked where she pointed her beam. There are more graves here, small ones, with small plaques. I read some of the dates, and realized that they are children's graves, with deceased ranging from infants to 6 or 8 years old. Of course, Mars's early colonists had families. There was little choice. Without future generations, long-term colonies were not possible. The economics of shipping new colonists from Earth didn't work before the gates. Without large families, there would be no townships today. But what an existence. What desperation to bring a fragile, innocent life meant to be born on Earth into this deadly frontier. But as I think about the Earth I have left behind, and of Mrs. Zinn, her orchid, and her lost son, I wonder if the risk is so much greater here.
Look here.
Matthew shined his light low on the wall. Sure enough, a rectangular screen covered a duct just large enough to admit a person. The tattooed man knelt and flipped open a multi-tool from his pocket and started to remove the screws holding the grate in place.
We'll have to move quickly. It won't take them long to figure out where we went.
With the panel free, he shined his light into the duct, squinting through the dusty air.
Okay, I'll go first. Then Lucy, Christopher, and Oliver last. Try to prop the grate back in place if you can. You won't be able to screw it back, but if it is off completely, they'll notice for certain.
Yeah, okay.
Oliver looked back over his shoulder nervously at the dark tunnel behind us. We crawled through, hunched low, and emerged at the bottom of a vertical rock shaft. It went straight up and was big enough around for the four of us to spread out a little bit. High overhead turned a circulating fan lit with dim maintenance lights. The strata of rock going up revealed varying shades of brown, red, and orange, a layer cake of the Martian eons. Other ducts led off in different directions from different heights.
Where next?
Matthew rolled stiff shoulders. The broad man was likely snug in that air duct. Oliver frowned at his tablet.
We're under the farm. This is one of the main shafts that pumps some of the air produced by the algae fields into the tunnels. But if we want to get to the farm itself and then to the train, we've got to get up there.
He pointed his flashlight to a tiny maintenance hatch at the very top of the shaft over a very small metal balcony.
That should lead to the air processing facility.
Are there any workers that might see us?
The sheriff told me the farm is closed for some reason, so I don't think so.
Matthew slowly turned to look at me.
Keeping company with the sheriff now, are you?
When I reported that Evan's home had been broken into, he interrogated me.
About what?
He thought I was one of you, actually, but he didn't say why they closed the farm, except in vague terms.
Lucy nodded.
Through some allies we have in the bureaucracy, we arranged for both the mine and the farm to be temporarily shut down so we could work undisturbed. The fewer eyes on what we do, the longer it will take for Shayot to find out.
She pursed her lips then.
Though not long enough.
But why would the Martian government be complicit with Shayot?
Oliver's face twisted in barely restrained fury.
Shayot owns the bloody universe. If they don't like you, they don't let you use their gates. Now who's going to stand up to that?
Lucy interrupted us with a quiet question.
How will we get up there?
Wait here.
Matthew eyed the walls of the shaft critically for a moment, and then simply leaped straight up an astonishing 3 meters. But, of course, I had forgotten the low Martian gravity, despite having been in it myself. With a climber's finesse, Matthew clung to the walls, spider-like, and used his strength in the low gravity to scale upwards. It wasn't long before he reached the narrow gangway in front of the hatch. Taking a rope from his pack, he tied it off and tossed down the other end to us. So, we climbed. I have terrible memories from my youth of being tormented by gym teachers, forcing us to do physical stunts just like this. It was humiliating then, but now, it was surprisingly easy in the low gravity. Also, in primary school, I did not have armed men chasing me as an incentive. When we were all huddled together on the metal gangway at the top of the shaft, Matthew dialed open the hatch. Beyond was the darkness of an empty, bunker-like building, set with desks, dark computer screens, and the whir and click of automated systems powering the air pumps and fans. A large window looked out onto the Martian surface, revealing sprawling, shallow fields of green-brown algae covering the ground in all directions. Oliver's face was lit by his screen in the dark.
Okay, easy from here. I reckon out that door over there, then take a left, then straight down the tunnel to the train station.
Lucy looked at Matthew.
What will you do about the men in the station?
I don't know yet.
I do not want them hurt.
We may not be offered that choice.
I heard something behind the door, the one leading to the train, something soft and rhythmic. Footsteps.
Someone's coming.
We scrambled for cover, behind control panels or crouching under a desk. The door slid open, and someone entered. His shadow fell across the far side of the room, and by his silhouette I saw he wore body armor and carried a rifle. I realized I was holding my breath. The soldier took a few more steps into the room, and then hurried over to the open access hatch we had come through, leading to the shaft.
Central.
The soldier was probably speaking into a headset.
I have an open maintenance hatch at ventilation control. Roger. Better send a squad.
Matthew moved with ghostly silence, stepping from his hiding place around the corner of a server tower, out of my line of sight. Both Lucy and Oliver were next to me, eyes wide, bodies tensed. The soldier left the open hatch and started moving around the bunker, rifle lowered in front of him. The room wasn't that large, and he would find us, eventually. There was no way around it. But I didn't know what else to do except freeze and hope. The soldier stepped into my view, boots treading on the floor next to where I crouched. I looked up just in time to see his eyes widen in alarm as he spied me. In that instant, Matthew appeared behind the soldier, his tattooed face looking monstrous in the dim light. He grabbed the man around the neck and hurled him to the ground on his back. The soldier gasped, the rifle spinning away to clatter to the floor. Matthew fell on him like a beast and kneeled on his neck, pinning his wrists with strong hands. The soldier gasped air, eyes wide, thrashing. But Matthew had sealed his airway shut. It took a lot longer for the man to pass out than I expected. He struggled, trying to punch and claw Matthew off of him. But Matthew merely took it, his expression stony. The soldier's face turned red, then purple, and his struggles weakened. More time passed, and the man's eyes rolled back in his head, and his lips turned blue. Finally, the soldier went limp. But Matthew kept leaning on his throat for a full 10 seconds more, before easing back. The man croaked as he inhaled, but does not wake up. Matthew leaned down with his ear to the soldier's mouth for a few seconds more.
He's breathing.
He then pointed at Oliver.
Lock that door. They'll be here soon.
Shouldn't we make a break for the train?
Matthew shook his head.
We'd never make it in time. They're already on their way.
Oliver hurried, muttering curses. He closed and locked the door and whipped out a small multi-tool to open up the panel that hides the door's electronics. I stared at the face of the unconscious soldier. He looked asleep, except for his blotchy skin and the bruise spreading over his throat. I was astonished at the speed and power of Matthew. Was he a soldier himself? Some sort of commando?
What do we do?
Matthew shifted uncomfortably, looking back at the hatch. His eyes were narrowed, and there's a hesitation in him I had not seen before. A man used to having answers, but now coming up short.
We can't go back down the shaft. It's a dead end. We can't use the safe room anymore, even if we could get to it. We can't get to the train tunnel.
His eyes then turned to the large window overlooking the algae fields and the airlock next to it. I followed his gaze to the airless Martian surface.
You can't be serious.
I am open to suggestions.
He strode over to a locker near the airlock. Sure enough, inside are 6 generic pressure suits. I'm no expert, but they look like the kind used for short-term use. Limited air supply, basic radiation shielding. He held one out to Lucy. She hesitated for only a moment before taking it and beginning to put it on.
Well, I mean, don't you have anyone you can call? Some other allies here on Mars? The friends in the bureaucracy you talked about?
Lucy slid her legs and arms through the slit on the back of her suit.
No. All of our Martian allies have been imprisoned or have gone dark. Quite possibly murdered.
Matthew handed me a suit and then starts helping Lucy on with her helmet. I stared at the shiny yellow fabric helplessly. Oliver walked back over to the group, putting his tool away.
They'll have to force that door now, but it won't... What are we doing?
Lucy's voice was muffled by the dome of her helmet.
We are going out onto the surface.
No. No! No, that's suicide! None of us are trained for it!
I am.
He calmly connected the air tank to Lucy's helmet.
Well, I'm not. There's radiation and dust storms and we're on the edge of the biggest canyon in the solar system without any climbing gear. If we don't get lost, we'll fall to our deaths. How much air is in those? A couple of hours? Not to mention they'll post guards at every airlock in this hemisphere. How are we going to get back in once we're out?
We'll follow the algae fields away from the canyon. The terrain is mostly flat. We'll head toward Eos Mensa. There are likely other bunkers we can try to...
The door to the control room buzzed.
Oh, Christ!
Oliver?
Sister, they're here!
Get in your suit. We will figure out what to do once we are outside.
Defeated, Oliver snatched a suit from Matthew and started trying to pull it on. I did the same. Fortunately, it seemed to be a straightforward design, like pulling on a jumpsuit. Matthew helped me with the back seal and connecting the air tank. Oliver sat on a small bench near the airlock, his face in the helmet bleak, like a man on the way to the gallows. Matthew donned his own suit and clicked the helmet into place while Lucy does up the back seal for him. The door buzzed again, and then there's a loud pounding from the other side.
Time to go.
Matthew made last-minute checks of everyone's suit and pointed out the airflow controls. I activated mine and felt the inner insulation of the suit swell, pressing snugly against my skin. Bottled air filled my nose. Matthew's voice came over a speaker in my helmet.
The suits share a short-range comm. Try to breathe normally to conserve oxygen. We're going to move to the edge of the farm, and then Oliver, you're going to find us an entrance on the map.
It won't make a bloody difference what my map says. There's no place to go, Matthew. We have to get off the planet.
But Matthew said nothing. He pulled a knife from his pack and cut 2 huge gashes in the remaining suits in the locker.
Christopher, grab one of the spare air tanks. Lucy, the other. It'll give us a little more time.
The air supply pack is bulky and heavy, but I gripped it tight. We all stepped into the airlock, and Matthew cycled it. It got deathly quiet as the air was pumped from the room to match Mars's near vacuum outside. The outer hatch opened. And then we were going. Just like that, I was walking on the surface of Mars. The algae fields were enormous. Shallow pools of brown sludge covered over with green-gold slime. Pitted metal catwalks crisscrossed the fields like spindly twigs over a lake. The silence was profound. Mars had stolen all the sound away. Mostly what I heard was the hiss of the air supply and my own breathing. Matthew led us to one of the catwalks, and we began to hike along it, over the bubbling algae. The fields released oxygen and other gases into the air that would, in another century or two, make the surface of Mars breathable. You simply had to cover Mars with slime to do it. The further we got from the bunker, the more exposed I felt. The hazy orange-colored sky offered no shelter, the stretching fields no cover, and the sun seemed so small, I was terrified of moving on this catwalk. A single rip in the suit meant death. Mars was dead. A corpse. A beautiful corpse, yes. But there was no life here. Naught but we humans who have crawled into its flesh and this algae we have painted on its surface. It would be so easy to die here. It's strange. A month ago, staring at the tracks in the All Saints train station on Earth, the thought of death was a temptation. But now it terrified me. Perhaps something to live for makes all the difference. I looked back over my shoulder toward the bunker, tiny in the distance now, a low concrete shape amid an orange rocky rise. This plan, this hope, it really wasn't going to work. Could we make it to some other remote airlock? And if we did, would it let us in? The idea seemed impossible.
Look, I think I might have an idea. It's very unlikely that we'll be able to get back inside without being spotted or getting lost or running out of air, correct?
Matthew hesitated a moment, then nodded.
It's going to be very hard, yes. Maybe we can find another farm or mining facility in the next township over where they won't be watching the airlocks. But it's going to take us a while to get there.
If we don't die trying.
In the meantime, they're going to be coming after us. We need help. We need to call someone. I mean, we need a distraction or information or something.
Lucy watched me closely now through her helmet.
There is no one. The three of us would not even be here on Mars, were there anyone left in our group here to handle things. We have no one we can call.
I do.
She raised her eyebrows at me.
Who? A friend. I met her on the way here. Her name is Catherine. She told me to call her if there was anything I needed. I think she might help us.
Oh, bollocks.
Why would she help us? We are essentially criminals. I don't know for sure that she will, but what would it hurt? How much worse can it get? If she says no, goes to the police, well, they're already looking for us.
She's not going to do it.
Maybe not, but it's someone on Mars who isn't actively trying to kill us and who we can ask for help.
It's a stupid idea. No one is going to help us.
I'm just trying to come up with a solution. I don't hear anything useful from you. You don't think anything is going to work.
He glowered at me, but had nothing to add. Matthew has remained silent this entire time, watching me and Lucy from behind his helmet. I could see Lucy weighing the options, her jaw clenched. Finally, she seemed to force herself to relax, and said very quietly to herself,
Providence.
Then she looked at me.
Try.
I held up my hand to Oliver.
You made a copy of my tablet, right? Her number is in there.
Still skeptical, Oliver tapped a few keys on his own tablet, awkwardly, in the pressure suit gloves.
I've set it to transmit audio to and from your suit.
He handed it over. I took a breath of the canned air and touched the screen to start the call. Matthew, like a sentry, watched our surroundings. Lucy moved closer to me to view the screen from the side. I pray I don't get her messaging system. Catherine's face appeared on the screen.
Hello?
She paused, squinting.
Christopher? Is that you? You look funny. I can't see your face clearly.
Oh, sorry.
I held the tablet up at arm's length.
Hello, Catherine.
Why are you wearing a pressure suit?
She looked like she was either getting ready for bed or waking up from it, her hair a little rumpled, her face well scrubbed. Even so, she seemed energetic and put together. That quality I admired when I first met her.
I'll get to the point. I'm in trouble. I need your help.
She raised both of her eyebrows in alarm.
What sort of trouble?
It's hard to explain, me and some others,
Suddenly I couldn't figure out what to say. I wanted her help, but I don't want to scare her off. Her expression softened a little.
Hey, whatever it is, just tell me, okay?
I gathered my thoughts and nodded.
Some friends and I are being chased by men with guns. We can't go to the police. We're stuck on the surface, we have nowhere to go, and the airlocks are being watched. We must get off of Mars, and I don't know what to do.
She opened her mouth and then closed it again, astonished.
That sounds like trouble. Yeah. The kind I would have never have guessed someone like you could get into. Some sort of organized crime thing?
Like I said, it's complicated, but Catherine, please, we have no one else to call. I know this is dangerous and strange, but I'm desperate. Please, can you help us?
Look, if you're on the surface, I can call you a rescue craft or something.
No, we can't have the local authorities involved. They're working with the guys who are after us.
Catherine worried her lower lip a moment, glancing off screen as if mulling something over. Then she nodded slowly.
Yeah, well, I know the township sheriffs are often corrupt. Where are you?
On the surface, at the Stratoline Algae Farm near St. Michael's Cathedral.
She smirked a little.
An algae farm? Couldn't you get into trouble somewhere fun? Hold on.
She tapped on a keyboard I couldn't see.
Okay. I think I know where you are.
We only have a couple of hours of air, and we need to get off planet.
We?
Yes, we, some friends.
It's complicated, right?
She sighed and squinted at something off camera, tapping on a few more keys.
Okay. Head east to the edge of the farm. There's a communications array there, and next to that, a shallow crater. Give me, 20 minutes, maybe 30.
Relief flooded through me like cool water.
Thank you. Thank you.
She smirked.
Don't make me regret this. But what kind of person would I be if I let you die? And how much trouble can you really be in? Besides, I need a little excitement in my life. All right. See you.
I couldn't believe it worked.
Well done, Christopher.
Oliver shook his head.
If she doesn't tell the sheriff where we're going,
she won't.
I'm not entirely sure why I was so convinced, but I was. Perhaps I simply needed something to trust in.
We need to go.
Matthew was watching behind us.
They're likely through the door, and it won't take them long to get more pressure suits.
Then let us go.
We hurried down the catwalk, taking long strides over the bubbling fields of slime. I was not as afraid of tearing my suit now. Hope is a powerful thing. But after 30 minutes of travel, even in the low gravity, I was puffing for breath, and my sides were aching from exertion. We've kept up a fast pace, and we're nearly across this first vast field. A ridge of rock has come into view, with towering dust devils swirling over it. Atop the ridge sits the communications array, antennae pointed skyward, signal lights blinking forlornly. The catwalk ended at the edge of the field with a few metal steps, covered in drifts of orange-brown sand. We scrambled up the gravelly slope to the array, and as we reached the top, we saw the crater she mentioned, a low basin of dust. There was no sign of Catherine. The array of antennae sprouted from a blocky concrete structure with no windows. There is a door, more like a hatch, really, covered in windblown sand, and Lucy tried it.
Locked. Where is she, then?
Matthew took up a position uphill and looked behind us.
Soldiers coming this way.
We looked, too, and in the distance along the catwalk, we could see tiny dark shapes moving toward us.
Oh, Christ almighty, Jesus. Enough, Oliver. Matthew, options.
At this point, making a run forward is our only choice.
What about that hatch? Can we force the lock?
Not without stronger tools.
You can blow it open. Don't you have more of the explosives from the dig?
And open whatever is behind it to the surface? It's probably just a maintenance hatch anyway, and it doesn't lead anywhere.
Oh, terrific. So where's your bloody girlfriend, then?
I scanned the horizon.
She said she'd be here.
Well, she isn't. She probably told the bastards exactly where to find us.
A shadow blotted out the distant sun. The ground vibrated under our feet, sand pulsing and sliding away in sheets. A sleek, onyx-black ship dropped out of the sky, shaped like a swallow and fitted with two gate skids on its back. Its engines blast white-hot flame as it slows and lands gracefully in the crater adjacent to us, sending an elegant plume of dust into the air. It's a small craft, not a shuttle, but a yacht, built for luxury and speed. The outer door of the airlock on its side opened, with signal lights blinking in encouragement. Catherine's voice pipes in over the suit comms.
Let's go. Hell, will you look at that?
We all rushed down the slope, plunging through the drifts of sand to reach the craft. I couldn't stop smiling. I caught Lucy's face, and she was smiling as well, though it is more measured.
A nice ship. Yeah, more than nice. It's got gate skids. This thing can fly through Shayot gates on its own.
As we climbed the short ladder to enter the airlock, he gave me a hard look.
Just a friend of yours, eh?
The outer hatch closed, and the airlock began to pressurize.
Might want to hang on.
Black ship rose from the Martian sand, scattering it into wing-like sheets. We held on to safety straps as it arced into the sky. An Invisible Sun is written, produced, performed, and composed by W. Keith Timms, and is a production of Alien Ghost Robot Creative Media. If you're enjoying the story, please tell your friends and family about it, and leave stars or reviews on your favorite podcast platforms. I hope you'll join us on our Discord server, or sign up for our mailing list so we can stay in touch. Members of our Patreon get to hear future episodes early, plus other cool perks for all our shows. Go to InvisibleSunPod.com for more information.